With that, we'll call the meeting to order. The clerk call the roll, please. And if we have speaker slips, would somebody turn them in?
So are you ready for the roll call?
Oh, especially if you're going to make it, Mr. Director.
Well, Jeff, are you making me do it? All right. He needs the training.
Thank you.
One of you do.
Thank you, Peter. Commissioner Shadian, Commissioner Blank,
here.
Commissioner Burke, Commissioner Clark,
here.
Commissioner Wessel,
here.
Commissioner Cram, Commissioner Neely,
here.
Commissioner Potter, Commissioner Riley,
here.
Commissioner Schallenberger,
here.
Commissioner Wong,
here.
Chairman
Kruger? Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you very much. I'll go back to Director Douglas for some announcements.
We'll go through the changes on the agenda, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And members of the public, if this is your first commission meeting and you wish to address the commission today, please fill out a speaker slip. They're found outside at the table, and we'll pass them up to the chair, and they can acknowledge you prior to your item being heard. For the agenda changes today, on page 16 of the agenda, there are no changes. On page 17, item 7A, the City of San Diego LCP Amendment 2-06 is postponed. Item 8B, the Scott Architecture Appeal, postponed. Item 8C, Surfers Point, is postponed. On page 18 of the agenda, item 9A, 606-126, would move to consent. Item 9B, 606-140, move to consent. On page 19 of the agenda, item 10A, Delmar Beach Club, move to consent. Item 10B, Greenberg, move to consent. Item 10C, the San Diego Pump Station, move to consent. And on page 20 of the agenda, item 13B, 10636, City of Arcata, is postponed.
Thank you. Okay.
Next, item 3 is the administrative calendar for the San Diego District. There's one administrative permit. There's no known opposition to this item, and we recommend that the commission concur with the executive director to approve this item on the administrative calendar.
Is there any objection to the executive director's determinations? Hearing none, we the commission concur.
And item 4 is the consent calendar for the San Diego District. There are two items today. Again, we are not aware of any opposition to these items, and staff recommends that the commission approve the consent calendar.
Okay, is there a
move consent?
Second. Moved by Commissioner Riley, seconded by Vice Chair Neely. They're asking for a yes vote. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved, the consent calendar.
And item 5 is the Deputy Director's report for San Diego. There are 3 waivers. We recommend that the Commission concur with the Executive Director's determination on these matters.
Is there any objection to concurring with the Executive Director's concurrence? Determination? Is there any objection to that? Hearing none, the Commission concurs.
And then I'd also like to report that there is a report on an emergency response to a sewage spill that occurred on March 31st at Buena Vista Lagoon. And this was a fairly large spill. There was 7.3 million gallons of raw sewage that was discharged into the lagoon. But the reports at the time and that are documented in this attached letter indicate that there was a fairly well-coordinated response from the 3 cities, Carlsbad, Vista, and Oceanside, the Department of Fish and Game, and the wastewater agencies, to limit the spill primarily to the eastern basin and to minimize the amount of fish kill and effects on wildlife. There was approximately 3 million gallons of sewage that were diverted or pumped and trucked out of the system to avoid discharge directly into the lagoon. And there is a pump-back system in place still that is withdrawing the contaminated water out of the lagoon and sending it to sewage treatment plants for treatment. This is ongoing. They're doing a habitat impact assessment that will be completed soon. And after that's complete, we'll know whether or not there are any actions that occurred or will have to occur that would require a coastal development permit. And that concludes the Deputy Director's report. The next item six are those items that were scheduled on the regular calendar and have been moved to the consent calendar by staff. They are items 9A, SDG&E, 9B, SDG&E, item 10A, the Del Mar Beach Club, item 10B, Greenberg, and item 10C, the San Diego Pump Station. I'd like to draw your attention to there are some addendum on these items. For items 9A and B, they are clarifications and corrections to the staff report, no changes to the recommendation. Del Mar Beach Club, it's the same thing. It was minor corrections to the staff report. And on the last item, 10C, there is a letter in the addendum where the agents, the biological consultant addressed the concern that staff had regarding the ability to landscape the bluff face to mitigate the visual impact of the shotcrete. And they've identified that, that's not possible under these conditions, that you need irrigation, and there aren't any types of plants that would be able to establish on the bluff face. So staff has modified the recommendation to accept the coloring and texturing to mitigate the visual impact in this particular case, and that's why we feel that it can be approved on the consent calendar.
Thank you very much. Before we do call for the question or ask for a motion, I have quite a few speaker slips here on these consent items, but they're here just, I assume, available for questions. Most of you have that down, so if I'm not correct, please correct me now, but right now I've got everybody down just available for questions. Okay. With that, I'll go to the Vice Chair Neely.
I would move approval of the consent calendar.
Is there a second to Vice Chair Neely's motion on the consent calendar?
Second.
So you can tell it's Friday. And Commissioner Sullenberger makes the second. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the commission has approved the consent calendar.
Thank you. And item 7B will be presented by Deborah Lee of the San Diego office.
Good morning, commissioners. Item 7B is the City of San Diego's LCP amendment number 2-06C, which provides for its citywide effort to address condominium conversions. The LCP amendment affects only the city's certified implementation plan, which is essentially the land development code, which was first reviewed and conditionally approved by the commission in 1999. Standard of review for an implementation plan amendment is whether or not the proposed ordinance conforms with and is adequate to carry out the certified land use plan. The city has multiple community plans that each include certified provisions to encourage and protect affordable housing opportunities. Several of these are noted in your staff report. Both the city and affordable housing advocates became concerned about the possible depletion of affordable rental housing in the city resulting from a dramatic increase in the number of condominium conversions that were occurring. Concerns were raised both due to the actual loss of existing older units that might be affordable, but also with the expected rise in rental rates resulting from a reduced supply of rental housing. Between 1989 and 1998, there were no conversion applications submitted. However, from 1999 till 2005, when the city began reviewing this issue, there were a significant number of conversions occurring, and the city's best estimate is that the approved conversions affected about 5% of the total rental housing stock. It has not been determined how many of these conversions occurred within the coastal zone. However, based on the information provided, it appears that about 13% of the conversions occurred in the beach communities. The city then embarked on a series of public workshops, planning commission, and city council hearings, resulting in a two-phase planning effort. The proposed ordinance before you provides for relocation assistance for all displaced tenants, improved noticing provisions, the adoption of minimum street-side landscaping standards, the adoption of updated parking requirements, preparation of a building conditions report for each conversion sought, basic utility and building code upgrades, and most importantly, in terms of the affordable housing issue, the provision of on-site inclusionary affordable housing units for any condominium conversion affecting 20 or more units. These components represent a significant improvement both in consumer protection measures and an enhancement of community amenities in the older neighborhoods. To a great extent, these provisions substantially addressed many concerns, and the number of condominium conversion proposals has dropped. After the Mello legislation in the early 1980s that transferred the Commission's affordable housing efforts to local governments, the Coastal Act's mandate for such housing efforts was curtailed. Nonetheless, given the standard of review and the certified land use plan policies, the protection of affordable housing opportunities, particularly existing affordable units or those being provided in the coastal zone, we still think it's an extremely important goal and a means of providing public access to the shoreline. For affordable rental units, the city's program typically requires them to be retained for 55 years. For affordable for sale units, the city's efforts have been to encourage home ownership, and its program utilizes an equity sharing approach. The city always has a first right of refusal on any subsequent sales or transfers, but the maximum term for any of the for sale units is 15 years, and an affordable for sale unit could no longer be restricted after only 1 year. Commission staff is recommending that the Commission adopt a suggested modification that would extend the retention of the affordable for sale units derived from condo conversions to 55 years. In addition, although the City and Housing Commission have stated that existing rental units already restricted due to some local, state, or federal mandate cannot be converted, there was nothing explicit in the ordinance. So suggested modification 2 provides that existing restricted units and buildings that contain them cannot seek a conversion until those restrictions have lapsed. In your addendum that we passed out this morning, you have an update of the two suggested mods that we're recommending. They replace the ones in your staff report on page 7 in their entirety. They're essentially, we did a lot of work with the city staff, which was very much appreciated, and we clarified that these provisions only apply in the coastal zone. They only apply to affordable units that result from condominium conversions, and the city requested that instead of life of the structure, we reference a specific time period. So we're utilizing the 55 years, which mirrors the rental housing restrictions. Plus, in the North City future urbanizing area, which is part of the coastal zone, the restriction on for sale inclusionary units there is also 55 years. So we've incorporated those changes. Our staff recommendation, therefore, is to reject the ordinance as submitted with the motions in your staff report, and then approve it with these two suggested modifications. I particularly want to thank Dan Joyce and the representatives from the City Housing Commission. This is a difficult issue, and it is one that essentially raises a policy approach. The city very clearly is trying to encourage home ownership. The city, based on statistics that they provided, has a very low home ownership percentage. So we understand that, but the problem that our staff is identifying for you is that for sale units to be limited to only 15 years, with even under an equity sharing approach, for 1 year for that unit to no longer be restricted and remain an affordable unit, we think does not represent the appropriate balance in terms of protecting affordable housing opportunities in the coastal zone. So we're recommending that that be extended to 55 years. And then again, just because of the concern about protecting existing restricted units, we felt that that was important to go ahead and codify that in the ordinance. So those are the two suggested modifications. Again, we're recommending rejection of that as submitted. And the motions, the applicable motions, are on page 6 of your staff report. That concludes staff comments.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'll go to the commission for ex parte, starting on my left.
On May 3rd, I met with several members of various environmental groups, jointly known as ORCA, who expressed their general agreement with the Coastal Commission staff recommendation on the site.
On May 8th, I met in La Jolla, California, with Dave Grubb and Gabrielle Somer, Coastkeeper and the Sierra Club, and at that time, they supported staff recommendation on this matter 100%. Anyone else? No one else? With that, we'll open the public hearing. We'll start with the City of San Diego, Daniel Joyce.
Yes.
And sir, how much time are you requesting?
I'd like 10 minutes if possible. I can do it faster. I'd also like to ask, is there any concern that I present the entire ordinance, or would you rather me get right to the meat of it with the affordable housing issue?
I'd get to the meat of it on Friday, and we'll give you the 10 minutes, but on Friday, if you get through earlier, you get extra bonus points on your flying anywhere in the world, you know.
I'm going for that. Okay, thank you. Good morning. Again, Dan Joyce of the City of San Diego. I'm a senior planner with the Land Development Code Division of the City Development Services Department. In June 2006, the City of San Diego, after more than 2 years of public input, workshops, ad hoc committees, and public hearings, approved regulations for condominium conversions that provide protections for rental tenants as well as prospective owners. If I could have my... Thank you. A condo conversion is a change of ownership from a single structure used for residential rental into individual ownership units under a condominium plan. Simply stated, it is a map action to change rental units into for sale units. There are no changes to density or intensity of use. City staff agrees with Coastal Commission staff that no modifications are needed to the condominium conversion regulations. The city, however, does not agree with staff that the City of San Diego needs to modify its inclusionary housing ordinance, which has many programs that do provide long-term affordability within the LCP areas. Get right to the meat of it now. The affordable housing requirements for condominium conversions are within the city's inclusionary housing ordinance. Currently, a converter can satisfy the affordable requirement on-site within the condominium conversion, off-site, or through payment of an in-lieu fee, which is currently $7.31 a gross square foot for projects of 10 or more units, and only $3.65 per gross square foot for projects fewer than 10 units. Most converters opt to pay the in-lieu fee. The proposed regulations will require that projects of 20 or more units do provide affordable housing units on site. The price is restricted to families earning no more than 100% area median income for the first family. And equity is shared between the Housing Commission and the owner for the first 15 years. This is an example of how the equity sharing works at year 1, year 7, and the 15 years. The prices are based on current pricing in San Diego. The median cost of a home in San Diego in March 2007 was $545,000. The restricted price for a family of four earning 100% AMI is $238,000. The difference, $307,000, is a subsidy that the San Diego Housing Commission provides. The equity sharing extends for 15 years. At 15 years, a homeowner receives all increased equity minus the Housing Commission subsidy. So if we were to look at this in year one, If the within the first year, if the first homeowner should sell the home, the Housing Commission would receive its subsidy of $307,000 plus 85% of the equity. The homeowner would receive 15% of the equity. Year seven, subsidy is still returned to the Housing Commission. That's $307,000. The Housing Commission now receives reduction, now at 49% of the equity, while the homeowner is beginning to receive some equity, here 51%. Year 15, the Housing Commission still and always will receive its subsidy of $307,000. However, at year 15, the owner now gets 100% of the equity built up into the home. Equity sharing provides many benefits, including improving a family's financial stability, providing future funding sources for education, a financial incentive to maintain the home, and a revenue source for the Housing Commission to use to assist other families. Long-term affordability is most certainly a goal of the City of San Diego. However, for-sale housing is not the best tool to implement that, especially with the condominium conversions. The City's affordable rental housing programs best achieve long-term affordability needs and goals of the City. Condominium conversions are typically older apartment buildings. Of the 10,406 units converted since 2001, roughly 3,500 were already 30 years old. And of those, 503 were built before 1950. Selling at a restricted price, similar to the price paid, is a disincentive to maintaining the home. Improvements do not translate into equity or profit. Long-term affordability is unattractive to lenders. Especially worrisome are dealings with foreclosures, requiring the Housing Commission to be second in place and make whole any possible losses, and that the units can only be sold to an income-qualified buyer all throughout a 55-year period of time. There is a limited pool of income-qualified families, and we have to think about this. Families earning 100% AMI. A family of four earning $69,400 a year must provide for all of the family needs, including food and clothing, health insurance, rent, car payments, car insurance, all the things that a family of four needs to do. The family must also have no to minimal outstanding debts. It must have good credit, and it must have a 3% down payment, roughly $7,000, on hand, all on an annual income of $69,400. We're talking about a family of four who's making the median income, having all their bills, still having excellent credit, having available money, and no debt to qualify. There are potential impacts to owners who might have to relocate once they do move in this, if you have a 55-year affordability standard. It's difficult to find a qualified buyer. As I just mentioned, the number of qualified buyers is a small pool of people. So it's difficult to find a buyer, possibly making relocation impossible. There is a possibility of replacing a restricted family on restricted income, in the position of having to sell at a loss because of increased interest rates or HOA fees. So for instance, if a family were to buy a home right now, 5%, 6% interest, they go to sell it in 7 years, 8 years, the interest rates are now 10%. That reduces the affordability, the amount of money a family at 100% AMI can pay for a home. So there are possible situations in which someone, if it's an income restricted over a 55-year term, there are possible situations where a family might even need to relocate, not even a choice. Family issues come up, work situations change, where they cannot afford to sell their home. They cannot find a buyer, or they may have to sell at a loss. For sale, long-term affordability makes the Housing Commission subsidy unavailable for a period of 55 years. That subsidy will lose significant value over a 55-year term. And equity sharing monies will no longer be available for other families needing assistance. It's important to understand that the for sale affordable housing for condominium conversions is only one single tool in the City's affordable housing toolbox. The City has other programs to provide long-term affordable housing and housing assistance. Other San Diego housing programs include the Inclusionary Housing Ordinance, which is applicable to all new development, the Coastal Overlay Zone Affordable Housing Replacement Regulations, Affordable Housing Density Bonus, programs operated by the San Diego Housing Commission. San Diego Housing Commission include commission-owned housing, first-time homebuyer assistance, rental assistance or Section 8 housing, housing rehabilitation programs, and family self-sufficiency programs. The city has worked with many groups over several years to develop these condominium conversion regulations, and I request that you certify this LCP amendment as submitted. I am available for questions, and also with me is Amy Benjamin from Arsenio Housing Commission. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. George.
Chris Christensen?
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Chris Christensen. I am here representing several property owners that are going through condominium conversion process.
Okay, your time you're requesting, sir?
I'd like to request equal time, but I'll try to summarize my comments in 3 minutes with possibly going into maybe 1 or 2 extra minutes.
Why don't we give you 5 minutes and do the best you can?
Thank you very much, Chairman. As I said, I'm Chris Christensen. My business is condoconversions.com. We're representing several applicants and owners of real estate in San Diego that are going through the conversion process, as well as in other jurisdictions throughout the state. We're here today to ask you respectfully to deny the motion as amended, to take no action. And the basis for my request is that there are currently adequate protections within the law and within the coastal overlay jurisdictional requirements that allow for the same goals that are being proposed to you today. I'd also secondarily, if the motion were to be approved, I would like to ask that an amendment be added to allow a pipeline provision so that people who are in the process and going through the process are not unfairly penalized, so that projects that are deemed complete from a certain point going forward would be applicable, but projects which are currently going through the very long entitlement process are allowed to continue under the regulations under which they applied. But generally, this policy is really an example of government paternalism at its absolute worst. I'd like to just request a laissez-faire approach. There's so many problems with the presentation that was just made, and there are so many holes in this issue. One of the most glaring omissions is the fact that the city of San Diego is currently in a declared state of emergency with respect to housing. Now, in layman's terms, a state of emergency typically implies that there is a suspension of normal operating procedures. But the reason that a state of emergency was put in place in San Diego is because the cost of for sale housing was spiraling out of control, going up in double-digit percentages year after year. The introduction of condominium conversions as a market-driven response to that provided a number of great benefits, not the least of which is it is the most affordable, market-driven, unsubsidized form of affordable homeownership within the city. But beyond that, the jobs that were created, the neighborhood revitalization, particularly in areas like Councilmember Hueso's district that have been neglected by government and neglected by policies over and over and over for decades, are now seeing revitalization. They're seeing people move in. They're seeing a sense of stewardship fostered in these neighborhoods. Again, we're having jobs created. We're having long-term income tax revenues come to the city by the reposition of these. And all we're doing is fixing up an aging housing stock within the city and providing home ownership opportunities, taking away the ownership from a rental owner that's going to use that as a business that usually lives off-site to people who live there, have a vested interest in that property, have a vested interest in that community, and are there to try to do the best they can to protect their assets, just like all the rest of us who live in single-family homes or new condominiums or any other type of housing. So again, what you're seeing here and what's happened and what was omitted in the presentation is the regulations became a de facto moratorium against condominium conversions. They were a reaction by the so-called affordable housing advocates who, to my knowledge, have never put an affordable housing unit on the ground. They just file lawsuits in response to very nebulous CEQA regulations and other undetermined legal determinations. And they've just created havoc for well-meaning, well-intentioned people who were providing development applications to the city of San Diego within the regulations and within the laws and within the development standards that were allowed at that time. When these regulations were put into place in the city of San Diego, it created havoc. And what you're not hearing here is the lack of revenues that have gone to the Development Services Department, the huge diminution of services and applications and fees. And what that really means is that less property in San Diego is being redeveloped, It also means that less homeownership, affordable homeownership opportunities are being provided, and there is absolutely no economic incentive whatsoever for owners to bring projects forward. And even more so with respect to my request for the pipeline provision, many of these owners have actually been punished because the rules have changed midstream. And I use the analogy that you're playing a football game, the score is tied, there's 2 seconds to go in the fourth quarter, the kick is up, and somebody moves the goalposts. And that's essentially what's happened in the city of San Diego. So again, just to reiterate my request, I'd like to ask you to deny the motion, submit it back to staff, try and get more current information with respect to the effects of the changes at the local level before bringing this back and making a decision. And again, we'd prefer that you take no action today with the understanding that there is adequate protection within the current laws. And if you do take action on this motion, to please allow for a pipeline provision so that the developers are not unfairly shouldering the greater societal burden of affordable housing. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And with that, I'll go back to the commission. Commissioner Wessel.
Excuse me.
Oh, staff, I'm sorry for your response.
Mr. Chairman, I have one observation and then turn it over to Deborah. But as you know, that this commission did have a history with affordable housing when that was a provision of the Coastal Act. In fact, the commission still has some responsibility for implementing an affordable housing program. Those are the residual units in Orange County that are still in the program. Subsequent to that, when the legislature amended the Coastal Act, taking out that provision, there have been subsequent amendments recognizing that maybe it didn't work as well as people had thought at the time that they repealed that provision in 1979, and there were several amendments made that urges the commission to take steps to protect affordable housing. Not the level of specificity that was there before, but at least a direction to the commission. And it really is was our experience that continued affordability is an important element. If you're really serious about providing affordable housing and not just talking about it, you need inclusionary housing and you do need affordability, continued affordability. And that's why we're recommending the extended period of time to ensure continued affordability. We think that's important and recommend that you accept the staff recommendation on that. Deborah, do you have any other comments?
Ms. Lee?
I can't augment what Peter said any better, but I'll just respond to a couple of the points that the one speaker made. We do think that condo conversions are an important element in trying to provide affordable housing, but we think that the city's proposed ordinance and the consumer protection measures in it, the updated street side landscaping and parking standards are equally important. So we would continue to recommend that you support those elements of the city's ordinance. And with regard to the pipeline provisions, that's really the city's prerogative, and they have laid out in the ordinance how different applications, where they are in the process, would be affected.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. And with that, I'll go back to the commission and Commissioner Wessel.
I just want to express a little disappointment in the fact that we don't have a full commission here. We have a few members. We had a few that decided to take Friday off, and I guess so. But I guess this is an important issue, and I think it merits the full attention of the commission. I hope that we can continue this item to the next or subsequent meeting to get a full hearing on this item before the entire commissioners, or at least more than, how many are we today, eight? More than just eight commissioners. I'd like to fully vet this issue and present it before the full commission. And so I'd like to move a continuance.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner Wessel, second by Commissioner Clark. They're asking for a continuance. Do you want to speak to your motion again?
No, I just asked in the interest of fairness and a full review of this process that we continue it.
Thank you. I'd like to add and support that continuance. I think Commissioner Wessel is correct. This is an area that I know he's been very involved in, and I have too, from the City of San Diego. I was on the first housing commission they ever had in San Diego and worked on this affordable housing. I was also vice chairman, head of the California Housing Finance Agency for years and studied this, and also on the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. That was my expertise. And I also have done condo conversions. And I think that I've read this, and I understand what staff's trying to do, and I am a real proponent of affordable housing. But you got to look at the mix and see how it's all done. And I think a lot of the things are in here. And I do apologize. I just would like to have more time myself to make a decision on this. I think it's a very important decision. I think what you're trying to achieve is good. But I think also the city of San Diego's representative had some very valid points also. So I will support the continuance. Commissioner Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think as this comes back to us, we really need to take a very close look in terms of our authority under the Coastal Act and the nexus between the Coastal Act and affordability. It was specifically taken out by the legislature. Peter references some legislation that may lead us in the direction of having some authority there. I'm not sure exactly what legislation you're talking about, but I think that we need to know that we're on solid ground relative to promoting regulations for affordability in the face of what typically has been a local government function. Cities and counties are required in their housing elements to do this, and we need to make sure that we're not at cross purposes with their strategies as we move forward with this, that somehow what we're doing integrates with the overall strategy of how the cities and the counties are approaching the affordable housing issue in local jurisdictions. So there's several layers of issue here, but the one that I'm most concerned about is whether or not we overreaching in using the Coastal Act to regulate local affordable housing issues.
Thank you, Commissioner Riley. Commissioner Wan.
Just a very quick comment. It's obviously going to be continued, and it'll come back. I am very supportive of affordable housing projects and maintaining affordable housing. I think it is important to look at the term of this if you're going to have affordable housing. It has to be meaningful in terms of the length of time and how quickly it can be converted back to non-affordable housing. I agree that we have to look at what our responsibilities can be or what the law says we can do under the Coastal Act, but I think that this commission has a long history of supporting where it can affordable housing. And so at this point, I'm frankly supportive of the staff recommendation, but I agree with Commissioner Krueger and support his desire to want to spend a little more time looking at it, so I will support the continuance.
Thank you, Commissioner Wan. Anyone else? Okay, with that, is there any objection to unanimous yes roll call vote on the continuance? Hearing no objection, it's unanimously approved. We're continuing the item. The commission.
Mr. Chairman,
just yes.
A couple observations. First of all, I was remiss at the beginning of the meeting to explain to you that Commissioner Ashajian, for example, had to attend a funeral today. He apologized for having to leave last night, and Commissioner Potter had an obligation as the chair of the Board of Supervisors for a task force meeting today, and I forgot to bring that to your attention at the beginning of the meeting. Relative to affordability, and sorry, Commissioner Riley left, I just wanted
Commissioner Secord's wife was injured too, so she
Oh, really?
Fowler. Mm-hmm.
I wasn't aware of that. Oh. I knew he dashed out of here.
Yeah.
I didn't know what the reason
broke
was.
Broke her foot, I think, or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that. The issue relative to affordability in the coastal zone, one of the things that we're finding is that people who work in the coastal zone, you know, whether they're rangers, teachers, firefighters, people who take care of visitor-serving facilities, can't afford to live there. And we're finding that there are impacts on coastal resources as a result of people having to drive long distances to get to their places of employment. The legislature recognized that the commission did have a history, and that there is something we can do, and gave us some general language. In fact, now Senator Lowenthal carried one of those bills, and I believe Senator DeCheney had the other one, which said that the commission should protect existing affordable housing and do what we can. They didn't give us the scope of authority that was in the original Coastal Act, but it did give us direction. And I feel very strongly, just to let you know where I'm coming from on this, that we need to do whatever we can to promote affordable housing because of the impacts on coastal resources, and it's the right thing to do. So those are all the reasons. We may not have the specific authorization to set standards and ratios and do some of the things that the commission did when it did have affordable housing as part of your program. But I think the least we can do is express our concerns and do what we can to make it realistic when we do have an opportunity to deal with affordable housing. So that's where we're coming from. And during this period of time, we'll have further discussions with the city staff on this provision. And if there's anything else you want us to make sure we look at between now and the time it comes back, we'll do that. And then the final thing is, we would like to get an extension of time on this for at least up to a year. Not that it'll take that long, but at least give us that period of time so that we don't run into the deadline problem for processing this.
Let me go to Commissioner Wasil first.
Yeah, I can't say I disagree with anything you just said. I hope that we can translate that into a meaningful policy that accomplishes that. In terms of the one-year extension, I understand that it's a matter of process, but in terms of is it possible that we can get a more time-certain date and vote today to bring it back at a specific date and task City of San Diego staff if they're okay with a certain date?
We would certainly discuss it with them. It would probably be a good idea to bring it back closer to the area, but if you want it back sooner than that, I mean, we're prepared to go today. We were. So there shouldn't be that much required in bringing it back within the next, let's say, July, if we can.
Sorry, July, okay.
And that's in San Luis Obispo. And given what you did yesterday on Parkside, I think July is going to be a four-day meeting now. So we could target July. But we still would like the extension just in case. We'll bring it back. But if there's something that comes up and we in the city agree we need more time, at least that's what council asked me to ask you.
Okay. Is there any objection from the City of San Diego?
Not necessarily objection. Our concern is that we do have a law. The City Council passed this in June last year, 2006. We have been implementing new regulations throughout the rest of the city. We're getting improved noticing for tenants. We're getting affordable on-site housing, whether it's long-term or short-term. We do have long-term programs, but whether it's that, we are getting it right now. In the coastal zone, we now have 11 months where we haven't gotten it. People are processing projects there. They're getting through the process. We are losing opportunities every time, every day we wait. We're losing affordable housing opportunities, and we're losing opportunities to provide good notice and protections and additional monies to people who are relocated. The sooner, the better. Right now, the relocation applies to people making less than 100% AMI. It's based on their current rent. You have seniors who are on fixed low incomes because they have good landlords who provide them with low rent. They would get more money for relocation under our program than they get now. So every day we wait, we lose opportunities for affordable housing. We lose opportunities to provide more assistance to people who are dislocated because of these. Thank you.
Mr. Wiesel, anything else?
Yeah, I'd like to see if we can resolve this by July if possible. Well, I'd really appreciate that.
We will bring it back at the July meeting, but just to satisfy the concerns that our council have, we would ask for the extension of time for no more than a year, but we'll bring it back in July.
Okay. Commissioner Juan.
Do we need a motion to? Okay. I'll move that the commission extend the time to up to 1 year.
Moved by Commissioner Wan, seconded by Commissioner Waso.
With the understanding we'll bring it back in July.
Exactly. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this extension? Hearing none, it's the commission unanimously approves. Thank you. Okay.
The next item, 7C, is a request to extend the time limit for commission action on the City of Carlsbad LCP Amendment 306 for Poinsettia Place for 1 year. Staff needs additional time to review this amendment. The city is aware of the request, and we will be working with the City of Carlsbad to prioritize the number of pending Carlsbad LCP amendments we have and which ones are brought forward to the commission first. But staff therefore recommends that the commission extend the 90-day time limit to act on the City of Carlsbad LCP amendment for 1 year.
Thank you. Commissioner Waso.
Yeah, I move that the commission extend the 90-day time limit to act on the City of Carlsbad LCP amendment number 3-06 for 1 year and recommend a yes vote.
Moved by Commissioner Waso, seconded by Vice Chair Neely. They're asking for a time extension up to 1 year. Is there any objection to unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the commission approves the extension of time per the staff report under F7C.
That brings us to item 8A. This is a appeal of the decision of the City of Oceanside for construction of an 82-room hotel and a nearly 4,200-square-foot full-service restaurant and four residential condominium units on a 3.8-acre vacant site that's fronting Buena Vista Lagoon in Oceanside. This appeal was filed by the commission and nine other appellants. And the issues raised in the appeal regarding conformity with the certified LCP and public access policies relate to the scale of development and the compatibility with the surrounding natural setting, impacts to public views, and protection and provision of a public vista point that's designated in the LCP, the proximity of the development to the adjacent wetlands of Buena Vista Lagoon, the provision of and timing and operation of the public access trail to address potential prescriptive rights that exist on the site. The appeal also raises some issues of the condo hotels in a designated visitor-serving zone and protection of lower-cost visitor-serving uses. 70 of the 82 units are proposed as condo hotels, and the city also did not address a mitigation for the potential effects on lower-cost visitor-serving recreational facilities in the coastal zone. And finally, there are issues related to traffic during the summer months, potential for flooding, and the effects of sea level rise. They've all been raised on the appeal. The staff is recommending substantial issue only at this time. We had indicated to the applicant that they waived the 49-day for the April meeting, and if it was possible for us to bring forward a recommendation on de novo, we would try to do that for the May Commission meeting. But we just received the updated wetland delineation the week before the mailing, and we received the city file the week of the mailing, and our biologist has not reviewed the wetland delineation yet, and we were not able to turn this around into a staff recommendation. Initially, I would like to draw your attention to the addendum. There is several letters of opposition, and there is a response from the applicant. There's a number of issues the applicant has indicated that they're willing to address that have been raised by this appeal, but the only way that those issues can be addressed by the commission is for you to find substantial issue at this time, and then we will work to try to bring it back to the soonest Southern California meeting. And therefore, staff is recommending that, unless three commissioners want to have a hearing on the substantial issue question, then substantial issue would be found.
First, I'd like to ask for ex parties. And I have an ex parte that's been on file, but also last week, May 8th, I had a breakfast meeting of which this subject came up. With David Grubb of the Sierra Club and Gabrielle Somer of Coast Keepers, and they supported staff in regard to this and would like to find substantial issue. That's the extent of my expertise. Does anyone else have any? None? Okay. And with that...
I would note that Commissioner Hueso has taken himself off of this, recused himself from this particular hearing.
Thank you, Commissioner Riley. With that, are there three or more commissioners that object to finding substantial issue? Hearing none, the commission finds substantial issue.
Thank you. And the next item is 9C, and Lee McEachern of our San Diego office will present this item.
9C.
Yeah, this is application 6-07-25. The applicant is the Logitory Pines. And this proposal is for temporary placement of chairs, umbrellas, and companions on the public beach during the summer months of 2007 and 2008 at Torrey Pines State Beach. It will be located about a quarter mile south of the South Torrey Pines Beach State parking lot, between the bluffs and the ocean, obviously. Staff is recommending approval of the two-year program with conditions that are outlined starting on page 2 of the staff report. The primary issue raised by this development is public access and more importantly, if this program is perceived as privatization of the public beach for obviously a private use. As I noted, the applicant is the Lodge at Torrey Pines, and it's a hotel located on Torrey Pines Road next to the Torrey Pines Golf Course. The hotel currently does not have any direct beach access, and therefore the facilities are proposed as a hotel amenity for its guests. At the same time, the applicant is proposing to make the facilities available to the public under the same conditions and the same costs as the hotel guests, and therefore it's also proposed as a public amenity as well. The three main issues raised by the development are the use of the Torrey Pines Beach public parking lot for storage of equipment containers, the as I mentioned, the appearance of the facility to be private use on a public beach, and then also the use of motorized equipment on the beach as well to deliver the facilities. As you can see in this slide here, slide number one, it's a slide of the South Torrey Pines Beach State parking lot. The facility where the chairs and companions will be located is further on down about a quarter mile to the south, but two storage containers are proposed in this parking lot right about in the middle of the screen where you see that lifeguard tower stored. Those storage containers will hold the chairs and companions and necessary equipment to operate the facility on a daily basis. As proposed, up to three parking spaces are going to be used to hold these containers. We were initially concerned with that, and we worked with the applicant. The applicant has indicated that they might be able to reconfigure it such that they could get it down to two parking spaces, but there's no way to locate the containers in this parking lot without affecting some parking. And to mitigate for that, the applicant is proposing to provide a public shuttle that will operate from the hotel down to this parking lot that will be available to not only guests but to the public on a daily basis whenever this operation is in effect. So that will, in effect, allow for some alternate means of getting to the parking lot and help to offset the loss of two parking spaces for the storage containers. The next issue is, let's see here, down, okay, there, okay. This is the location about a quarter mile down the beach where the facilities will be located. There will be a number of companions and the chairs and little tables and stuff too. And the issue raised by this is that as the public moves down through this facility, it's going to look like a private operation and either deter public access or repel the folks from wanting to go in this area. In order to address that, we've recommended a number of special conditions on the permit that include, among others, no storage of equipment on the beach overnight. There can in no way be any area of the facilities that are roped off or make it look like it's private in any way. The chairs will be located on the north side of the beach in an area that, as the public moves down from the parking lot, that'll be the first thing they see, so that it'll be more perceived as inviting. And that there should be signs installed, not only at the facility, but up in the parking lot, too, making it clear that these facilities are here and that they're available to the public as well, too. This is just a view looking down the beach from the parking lot. The facility is just about the end of the screen here. You can't really see it here. This is just as you're moving down the beach. Here is what the cabanas and the chairs will look like. There will be up to 10 cabanas and up to 20 chair sets with a little table and umbrella on it, located on the beach at any time. State Parks has limited it that it needs to be a certain distance back from the bluffs for safety. I think it's 60 to 80 feet. And they will also try to keep it up away from the wet line as much as possible as well, too. The last issue, let me go down here, we think is significant is, and that has been raised by opposition, is the use of motorized equipment on the beach. In order to get these facilities out here from the parking lot, they proposed the use of that little mule. Where did we go here?
Okay. Don't insult mules, will you, please?
Can we bring that back up to where we were a second ago?
Chris.
They call it a mule. It's just a little four-wheel hauler. Okay. Let's see here. It's that little vehicle right there. And what they do is they just, you know, from the storage containers, wheel on down the beach and set these facilities up. The concern is that you don't want these vehicles, it's a motorized vehicle running up and down the beach, you know, not only disrupting beachgoers, but, you know, potentially raising a hazardous concern as well, too. And so staff has recommended a condition that the mule operate only in the early morning and the late evening, so that's when beach use will be at the least used, and that it'll have the potential to impact the public the very least. And although the development includes private facilities on the public beach, the facility is, like I said, a quarter mile down the beach in an area that's less heavily used than the more popular beach next to the parking lot. With the proposed conditions recommended by staff, staff feels that the facilities will not interfere with public access and, in fact, will provide a public amenity that is not currently available in this location. In addition, the permit is conditioned for 2 summers. During that time, the applicant is required to provide some sort of monitoring, so when they do come back beyond the 2008 summer and wish to continue the program, they will have some information on the use and how it's operated and what impacts have occurred and stuff that the commission will be able to use for further review of the permit. And with that, staff recommends that the commission approve the development as conditioned in the staff report. And I do want to note, too, that there was a couple minor additions made to the staff report in the green addendum packet. That concludes my comments.
Mr. Chairman, just some observations here. Kind of bear the process that we go through internally, but I have some real mixed feelings about this project. And we didn't spend the kind of time, I think, looking at the implications of this. I'm not changing the staff recommendation, but I am suggesting that there are serious issues that are raised here by this kind of use on a beach, whether it's visual or impact on public access. And I really look to your guidance in terms of what you think is appropriate here, and whether or not the term ought to be shortened. But this is not a robust recommendation on our part.
Thank you, Director Douglas. With that, I'll come back to Commission. Vice Chair Neely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Commission approve Coastal Development Permit Number 6-07-025 pursuant to the staff recommendation. Recommend a yes vote.
Moved by Vice Chair Neely, seconded by Commissioner Riley.
I think
ex parte context.
I'm
hearing.
Sorry. Yes. Thank you.
It's Friday.
Thank you. Ex parte, starting on my left. Thank you. I had one ex parte on with Gabrielle Somer of the Coast Keepers and David Grubb of Sierra Club on May 8th last week, Friday, for breakfast, at which time that they recommend to support staff on this. They looked at this. As long as there's signage and it's open to the public and it provides public amenities that it's open to the public that are not there now and where it's located, they support that. And that's the extent of my, our ex parte on that. Okay, anyone else?
Okay. I just want to compliment the chair on making sure that our council stays awake during hearings.
Mr. Chairman,
indirectly.
I just have a question.
Yes, Commissioner Blaine. But wait a minute.
I'm sorry.
There's no. There's just one here to answer any questions. Okay. Okay. Okay.
Okay. So you have one speaker who's here to answer any questions that you may have. So I think you need to open and close the public hearing.
Okay. We'll open the hearing, and Mr. Evans is here, and to answer any questions, and unless he wishes to speak now, he can come. Yes, Commissioner. Okay.
Yeah, could the applicant come forward, please?
Yes, sir. I'm Bill Evans, representing the Lodge at Torrey Pines.
Mr. Evans, I'm supportive of the motion. Question I have is on signage. Signage could be very important in terms of the public being aware that this is a public use facility besides for your lodge. What kind of signage is envisioned here?
Well, there's passive and active signage on this project proposed, one of which is anybody who goes to the state park, it's greeted by a ranger who takes a small honorarium for parking there. And at that point, there's a handout that is given that clearly says this is a partnership between the state park, Lodge at Torrey Pines, and there's complimentary seating if they so wish, or if they'd like to have a cabana, the same rules apply for the guests of the lodge, they can do that. Then there's also signage, permanent signage at that kiosk, larger. And then also at the actual location, there will be prominent signage on the north face as well as the south face. So,
and the signage at the location will be very clear in terms of it being indicating this is open. This is open to the public. Public facility.
It is. In fact, we've looked closely and working with the state park, and it's really the Lodge at Torrey Pines logo is about half the size of that of the state park logo on the signage.
But it'll be very clear that it open to the public for public use.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Also, I'd also the tents that you see in the thing. If you go to Torrey Pines State Park any day of the week, even in the wintertime, in recent years, people are bringing their own tent structures down there in a whole variety of colors, and we took a lot of effort to make it look like we blend in quite well. If you look at the color palette, et cetera, it's not trying to be glaring on the coastal bluff.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Evans.
Thank you.
I'll go back to Vice Chair Neely and then Commissioner Schellenberger.
Mr. Chairman, I would just put that motion back on the floor again and recommend a yes vote.
Moved by Vice Chair Neely, seconded by Commissioner Riley. And they're asking for a yes vote to on this particular item. With that, I'll go to Commissioner Schellenberger.
Yeah, just a couple of questions for staff that I couldn't find in the staff report, and I apologize. How many rooms are there in the Torrey Pines Hotel?
Mr. Evans can respond to that.
Mr. Evans, could you come forward?
I think
forward?
He knows the answer to this question.
We have 174 rooms.
Thank you. And while you're here, is the hotel going to be providing parking for the public, for those people who want to take the shuttle to the beach?
We currently have 40 spaces that are dedicated for public use at the Lodge Torrey
Pines. And are there signs saying that it's
yes, it's an agreement with the city of San Diego.
Okay, thank you. My concern with this is, well, let me say I disagree with the executive director. I have no mixed feelings about this one at all. The way it's set up is, it talks about it being available to the public as well as the hotel residents, but there is you can reserve them a month in advance, and the cabanas are $100 a day. So the way I envision this happening is when a person calls and makes a reservation at the Torrey Pines, probably several months in advance is my guess, and after they make the reservation, the operator says, and would you like to reserve a cabana for $100 a day? And they say yes or no, and you go on a waiting list. Or if that's not allowed, they say, well, you can't reserve it until a month before, but if you call back on such and such a date, we can reserve a cabana for you. So we have 170 people, assuming it's full during the summertime, which my guess is it is, all getting being asked well in advance if they would like to have two chairs and an umbrella on the beach for free, or if they would like to rent a cabana for $100 a day. This is not public access. I don't care how many signs you put up there. The odds that any of those cabanas are available on the day that somebody arrives, a member of the public arrives at the beach and wants to sit in two chairs or rent a cabana are probably pretty darn close to zero. I appreciate that these cabanas are, in fact, fairly good looking and they're all the same color and they go in. They are not, you know, inconsistent with the natural palette. And for $100 a day, they shouldn't be inconsistent with a natural palette. So I find this completely, it is a token only available to the public. There will be no public seats other than what people bring themselves. And I predict there are no cabanas available on any one day if you go down and try and rent it, even if you have $100 in your pocket. And it suddenly makes the state beach, that area which is currently free to put up your own cabana, your own umbrella, now is $100 a day to a private hotel. Wow. So I find this absolutely not public access. It is making these 10 cabana areas effectively only available to the private hotel residents, and I would urge this commission to vote this down.
Okay, Commissioner Schellenberger. Commissioner Clark, Blank.
I just have a question to staff. It said the proposed program operated during the summer of 2006 with the permission of state parks. Was it that we just didn't get any communication from state parks about this program, or the public, I guess, raised this issue? Is do state parks have a policy of permitting this? Is this the first time we've... I'm just kind of confused about the coordination issues.
Yes, this is the first time that this has been brought forward to the commission, and it was brought to staff's attention last year. It was the first year that we're aware that state parks had entered into a concession with the Lodge of Torrey Pines for this very similar proposal. And it was at the towards the end of the summer that we became aware of it. That's what the pictures are right. from. And we told them it needed a coastal development permit, but because that, you know, it was near the end of its term last year, we didn't do any follow-up from last year's action. This is the first that it's been brought forward to the commission okay. for this year and next.
So that raises just a bigger question across the state. Have we just explicitly asked state parks if this is going on in any other beach areas, that if they have any other programs? I just wondered if this was a local action from state parks or...
It's my understanding it is localized here, but it's not an unusual experience that we have with state parks. There's a kind of lack of coordination and communication that's endemic to the institutional structure that we live with. Some park units are better at understanding that any use like this requires a coastal permit. There's turnover on state park personnel that don't know what the coastal rules are all the time, and we have to constantly be reminding them. In fact, we're doing that right now on the North Coast and other places. So this is not an unusual experience. We're trying to reduce it, but it is frustrating, but it's okay. Comes with the territory.
Okay, and the last question, if I can. Commissioner Schallenberg's comments actually concerned me as well, and that just makes me want to question page 8, last paragraph, which said, requires full 10 sets of free chair umbrella units. Can you go back again? Is this free or $100 a day?
The chairs and umbrellas are free. They right. can be reserved.
Right.
But they are free of charge to the public and the hotel guests.
But it's the so the lower class facilities are free to the public.
And the cabanas are $100 a
and
day.
And as Commissioner Schallenberg pointed out, so the hotel guests could reserve all those chairs before the public gets to them. Is that correct?
That's correct.
As currently proposed.
Yes.
I'd like to have Mr. Evans come up and clarify this so it's clear in my mind, too, about these charges so all of us commissioners understand. What.
Yeah. To answer a couple questions, I don't know if there are questions or statements. The piece of beach that we're referring to is, I invite you to go down there on the 4th of July because unlike every other piece of sand in Southern California, I think it's closer to what is at San Onofre. It's about 5 miles of empty beach. It is absolutely desolate, even on 4th of July weekend. Past the last lifeguard stand, there's an abundance of open beach. I mean, you'll go 500-600 feet without even a single person. So it really is the most unused portion of beach other than probably San Onofre or Camp Pendleton. The people that come to the Lodge of Torrey Pines in the summertime, over 85% of them are from California. Most of them don't have the luxury of living on the coast themselves. And so it really is their beach as well that they're coming to. The only thing we're providing is the facility for them. Last year, this program, it cost us $47,000 for this program, for the labor to set these tents up. These are not made to be set up every day. It's very, very labor intensive. And it's very, very difficult for us to do this. And I wish we had the problem that every single cabana was used every day and every chair. We had spotty attendance at best last year for this program. And this is when we had full concurrence of state parks. We did not know that it had to go before this commission. And we worked hard at it. But people are going to SeaWorld. They're going to the zoo. They're doing a lot of other things at that time. Thank you.
Yes. Commissioner Clark.
Mr. Evans, could you come back? I think, though, Commissioner Schallenberger raises an interesting point. It seems to me her point is how do we ensure that the public will have the availability? And notwithstanding your observations that there's spotty attendance at it, you still do it and you want us to approve it. It would seem to me that you would want to think about proposing, or may propose, an additional special condition that would actually reserve some of the seating in a cabana. How many cabanas are involved?
A total of 10.
At least 1 to 2 that would not be reservable, and maybe more, 1, 2, or 3, in advance by your guests, but open to the public. And then on the day, as the day proceeds, they'd be made available. But at least, I think she's got a legitimate point in terms of if, in fact, there is a high demand, one of the things that would make this palatable is the fact that it's open to the public, but it's got to really be open to the public.
Well, I understand that, sir. Just trying to give an example is what last year, what we probably 5% of all cabanas were done before. I mean, we were really, selling as hard as we could with our concierge and upon check-in offering it to people. People tend not to want to be locked into something prior to. They don't know if the weather's going to be. They don't.
Right.
So it really hasn't been a problem. I think it's part of the staff's suggestion to do monitoring of this so we can fine-tune it, because hopefully we just don't want to do this for 2 years. We'd like it to be a successful program that's good for state parks, because we'll be paying them $5,000 a month for the ability to do this, which we're trying to keep in the state park. The chairs also, I think that the tables, the freebies, as we call them, that those would not be reserved in advance. And those, we could hold all of those every day if we'd so choose.
Well, but based on what you've said, it would seem to me that up to three could be held as not reservable in advance and open to the public, and if not used, then part of your inventory. And I think that would at least accommodate her observation, which I think is a legitimate observation.
It'd be no problem to do that.
Okay.
Thank you. Commissioner Warren?
I've been thinking about this, and I not only agree with what Commissioner Schallenberger said, but even some more important issues. And by the way, making it so that you can't, there are some that aren't reserved in advance may improve it, but it doesn't change the basic underlying problem. And in addition to what we're talking about here, it sets a terrible precedent for the rest of the state. I am not aware of us doing this anywhere. When someone came to this commission in Malibu wanting to put umbrellas and rent umbrellas to put on the beach, this commission turned them down. And those were available on a daily basis because it's privatization of a public beach, and I can't support it.
But I'll go to Vice Chair Neely, and I would like to weigh in on this also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, is that me?
No, go ahead.
All right, sorry. Just wanted to say that I think special condition number one addresses most of the identified concerns in terms of public use and making sure that this is available to the public to the greatest extent possible. I think the condition also includes a condition about no more than 25% of the site should be occupied by fee-based facilities. So that's a regular condition that we put in. Condition number two further emphasizes that the facilities are all available for public use. Special condition number three requires the placement of signs, and we've talked about that and got the information from staff. Special condition number four stipulates that all the proposed facilities are to be removed from the beach overnight and stored in the containers. And special condition number five puts in the monitoring piece to make sure the commission can review it. And, you know, contrary to what some of my colleagues have said, I think that the state park should be commended for doing a collaborative effort with, you know, to generate more access to the coast. So I think it's a great partnership, and I applaud them.
Thank you, Vice Chair Neely. And I'll go to Commissioner Riley.
Well, in terms of public use, to put things on an even footing, on number two, condition number two, I'd prefer just to see these amenities available on a first-come, first-served basis, period. And I know staff is willing to incorporate that, or if you want a motion on that.
In other words, the cabanas, they would just be available on a daily basis,
right.
First come, first serve. That's fine. We'll incorporate that.
Okay. That takes care of it for me. And, you know, if we were going to ban people bringing their own tents or their own cabanas and stuff like that to the beach, which they do on a regular basis, I could see why you'd want to prohibit this, or people don't want to go to that that they're traveling from other areas and don't have a tent with them or want to have access to one. I see that as a public amenity. I don't see that as a violation of beach particularly.
Thank you, Commissioner Riley. I've been down to this part of the beach, and at my age it's too far to even walk. And there's no one ever even down there. And I see this as a good test project, a pilot project, you say, for 2 years. It's totally monitored. It's bringing infrastructure, bringing things down to the beach to it, maybe attract more people down there. And if it's on first-come, first-served basis or things are open to the public, I don't know what the harm is. It's going to be an attraction, not a detraction. And if you've ever been down there, and the local people that I talked to, the environmental community, they had no problem with this. And I'm having problem. My problem is I think that we should give this a chance, and this is a good sponsor to be doing something like this, something can be trust and follow through with it. And I think state parks, it's good. They can get revenue, put it back into state parks and the resources, et cetera. And at the same time, it works to attract people where they normally wouldn't go. I think this is a good program to try and test it out. And it's with the right people to do it with. So I'm going to support the motion. Okay.
Application.
Yes, you can, Commissioner Schellenberg.
I just want to be sure I understand that it has been incorporated now. There's no reserving of cabanas or the chairs and umbrellas.
That's correct. First come, first serve.
Okay. Did you want to say something before we vote, Mr. Evans? Was there some question you had of the committee?
Operationally, that's, I mean, it's fairly difficult. Would a compromise be that for the it's just so much effort to set these up and then to see that they would set them all up and then have no usage on the day, it could be difficult. And that was the biggest problem we had last year, and the biggest expense last year is that we thought there was going to be a lot more utilization, so we had a policy of setting everything up. And it's a Herculean effort. It's the reason why we have the machine to bring the things down to set it all up. And if what we don't want to do is start underestimating and then turning people away, public or you know, the public that are staying at the hotel. So operationally, it would be very difficult. I think if we did maybe a 50% for the first year and then maybe staff recommend if we, you know, extend that later for the next year, it might be more operationally correct. Because what I want to do is be able to provide as much opportunity for the general public as possible. And if we have to take a running bet and guess what it's going to be every day, I think it's going to be difficult.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
I just want to respond to that. Currently what they're proposing with if they were reserved, let's say I'm hearing that only 50% of them were reserved some days. Under this, as I read it, all 10 need to be put up every day because it's whatever isn't reserved is available on a first-come, first-served basis. So all we've done is change the number of those that are available on the first-come, first-served basis. So I don't find this argument at all persuasive about why we shouldn't actually make all of them rather than just those that aren't reserved available on a first-come, first-served.
But I think
I'd like a vote.
Yeah, we will, but let's clarify this for a minute here. I think what Mr. Evans is saying is that if they put up all the cabanas, and if you go there, it's quite a distance, and you haul all that up, it has to be put up and down every night, and maybe there's no one that wants to use it at all. And what he's suggesting is there some kind of 50% or some kind of advance, so they at least have some. So it's not a total loss that they set them all up.
They have to set them up anyway under the current proposal. Because otherwise they're not available.
I don't understand it.
I don't believe.
I mean, they can get indications from their guests about how many guests are intending to use it any given day and give them a sense of how many to set up, but it's not a formal reservation.
Okay.
Excuse me, that does not work. That means that if guests indicate that there are only five sets of guests who want the cabanas, they only put up five. That is another way of saying that the other five are not available to the public on a first-come, first-serve.
Well, let's clarify that. Are 10 cabanas available to the public every day out there?
Yes,
I'd like to clarify, actually, on condition number 1C on page 3, they are only able to put up the number of cabanas that are reserved. So the number of cabanas can vary according to reservations. And that's how the proposal was made.
What I would be willing to do is not take reservations earlier than 24 hours. So, I mean, we'll set them up, but at least we have some type of idea. So for us to bring all the vehicle trips on the beach for nobody to use them doesn't make much sense either. And this area of the beach historically has not been used by the general public of the city of San Diego. It's a ways from their car. It's just a long way. So though we might think there's going to be a big gold rush to these free facilities, we've yet to really see that.
Mr. Chair, I think Commissioner Schellenberg is right. If you have any kind of a pre-reservation system as determining the number of cabanas that are set up, then it effectively is not available to the general public, I think. And so if they're going to have cabanas rather than just beach chairs and stuff like that, I think it's all or nothing.
Okay. So that's what's in the motion right now, I take it. Okay, Commissioner Clark.
Yeah, staff, I'm confused then, because if I look at paragraph C and read this, what does it mean when it says, however, the number of rented cabanas set up each day may vary according to reservations, but cannot exceed 25% of the total?
That's something that we would have to also clarify, because we've removed the reservation system. And so we should clarify that each day all 10 cabanas need to be placed out on the beach.
But the original intent, as recommended by staff, was only 25% could be reserved.
No, that's just the physical area.
Oh.
It's the physical area of the beach for the concession that would be limited to the cabanas.
I got you.
Okay.
Commissioner Wong.
In regards to what Commissioner Schallenberger has been talking about and Commissioner Riley, I really don't see how requiring it on a first-served, first-come basis changes anything in the operation. If right now you say that whatever is not reserved in advance is available to the public, you still have to set up all 10 cabanas every day, because you don't know that morning that the public won't come. If you've got 5 reserved, that the public wouldn't come and want to reserve the other 5. So how are they not, are you not having to set all of them up regardless?
Well, from what I understand, what we have negotiated with staff was that the beach chairs and umbrellas, that is something that really is going to be what we have thought based on historical usage. That is something that people will come up and say, I want a beach chair, I want an umbrella, can you help me out? And it's free of charge. The cabanas, we thought, because of the price point, would be something that would be more doing with families and people that are going to pre-plan their time at the beach. And that was our intent.
So effectively, this is designed, as Commissioner Schallenberger said, for the hotel guests, the cabanas. They are not effectively there for the public.
That's not our intent, ma'am. Our intent was that we thought that if people from the community were going to be utilizing them, that they would do so within a 24-hour period in advance. It wouldn't be a spur of the moment. A lot of people don't bring $100 to the beach.
Okay. There's a motion and a second, and they're asking to approve with the modifications that modification Commissioner Riley talked about. First come, first serve. Okay.
And all have to be erected every day. 10 cabanas a day on a first come, first serve basis. Yes.
Let me ask before I vote on that too. Is this something that, again, it's for 2 years and working with staff, if something, the hotel, if this is approved today and they come to you in 6 months or a year and say, this has been our experience and you've been monitoring it, maybe we can come back and modify or something if it isn't working, you know, either way.
Well, they can certainly come back for an amendment, and the monitoring is intended to see what our experience is. So this is kind of experimental.
There are several days during the summer with very, very high tides that it's the state parks are not comfortable with us installing it because it will block access. So there will be some days, Commissioner, that there would be no utilization at all.
Right.
No setup
at all.
Okay.
And this would not mandate that.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Okay, clerk, call the roll, please. Asking for a yes vote.
Commissioner Blank?
Yes.
Commissioner Clark?
Yes.
Commissioner Neely?
Yes.
Commissioner Riley?
Yes.
Commissioner Schallenberger?
Yes.
Commissioner Wan?
No.
Chair Kruer?
Yes.
6.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Evans,
six,
for coming.
6-1.
It's 6-1. It's approved for the modification.
That brings us to the North Coast. And while Bob is coming forward, let me just report to you on one item, action item that we took. I think I explained it already to a couple of commissioners. We did have a request from Del Norte County for an emergency permit to breach. Have we just lost our quorum? I think we did.
Yeah, we did.
Hang on.
It was only the chair.
Anyway, we were asked for an emergency permit to breach Lake Earl, which those of you who've been on the commission know has been controversial for many, many years, on the basis that the high waters in the lake were flooding roads and driveways, private property. I happened to be up there at the time and went out and did a site visit, and turns out that only one road had water on it, and that was Kellogg Drive out to Pacific Shores, where I think there's only one house there that's legal. And there was a car driving through it, a small car, so they didn't have any problem. I saw no driveways, other roads flooded, so we denied the emergency permit request. The environmental consequences of draining that lake at this time of the year would have been widespread and significantly negative. So on that basis, we told the county that they could not, there was no emergency warning of breach. So, and that's an ongoing issue that we have, and you'll hear about it again in subsequent years, but I just wanted to report that to you. Bob, do you have anything you want to report?
In addition to the emergency permit that I wanted to report that Director Jeglis has just done, there is a pink addendum which contains one permit waiver from the City of Arcata for a lot line adjustment. And we're aware of no opposition to this development and recommend that the Commission concur with the Executive Director's determination regarding the matter. So through the Chair, we'd ask whether there are any questions or objections to the waiver at this time.
Is there any objection to finding concurrence with the Executive Director's determination? Hearing none, the Commission concurs.
Okay, and then before we launch into the next item, I'll just, for housekeeping, just indicate that in addition to the pink addendum, we distributed three addendums on each of the three North Coast items that you should have in front of you. And then there also was a handout from the representative of the Elliott appeal. The item 13A is an application of Pacific Union College for improvements to the college's Albion Field Station along the Albion River on the Mendocino coast, which include construction of a 1,600 square foot T-shaped boat dock, removal of an existing 3,800 square foot boat barn in wetlands, and construction of a new boat barn to replace it in an upland area, and installation of a bridge over an unnamed creek to provide access for the boats in the boat barn, and construction of various other improvements and removal of existing improvements from creek areas on the site. As I mentioned, there is an addendum for this item. The addendum makes certain additions and corrections to the staff recommendation and adds a special condition number 20 regarding exotic vegetation removal and monitoring at the site of the removal of the boat barn. We felt it was important to ensure that as it's removed, the intent that native plants recolonize the site actually occurs and it's not invaded by invasives. We also add findings to support this condition. The staff's recommending that the Commission approve with conditions this coastal development permit. The principal issues raised relate to whether the placement of fill and the excavation activities are consistent with your wetland fill policies and environmentally sensitive habitat policies. And staff believes that with the attachment of the 20 special conditions now, the proposed project would be consistent with sections 30233 and 30240 of the Coastal Act. There are approximately 30 12-inch diameter piles involved with this, resulting in about 22 square feet of structural wetland fill. And there's also about 1,600 square feet of floating boat dock that would be placed in wetland areas. Staff believes that these facilities constitute expanded, newer expanded boating facilities consistent with Section 302.33A3 of the Coastal Act as a permissible use for fill. We also note that the docks have been designed to minimize their extent so that they can't be used for other purposes other than just simply accessing the water. And so we think that the fill involved with that is consistent with your wetland fill policies. Among the conditions, I'll point out that we do have a condition number 3 that requires the applicant to submit an eelgrass monitoring plan for the review and approval of executive director. That's to ensure that there's no impact on eelgrass, and if there is, then the requirements that they have to come back for a permit amendment to remediate that. The expectation is that there will not be those kinds of impacts. there's also requirements limiting the steel pile treatment to not use epoxy or other types of materials that would create water quality impacts. And we also have conditions limiting the timing of construction to occur only at low tide and only during the period of time between June 1st and October 15th to avoid spawning and migrating salmonids. So as conditioned, staff believes the project is consistent with Chapter 3 policies of the Coastal Act, and we recommend approval of the project by adoption of the staff recommendation as modified by the addendum. And the motion can be found on page 7. And that concludes my remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Any ex-parties starting on my left? No ex-parties. I'll open the public hearing. Gilbert Meth? Muth? Yep. Mr. Muth, thank you, sir. And how much time are you requesting?
Questions.
Questions only? Well, thank
yes,
you, sir.
I'm in full support of the staff report.
Thank you, sir, and thank you for coming today. Okay. Okay. Vice Chair Neely?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Commission approve coastal permit number 1-06-018 pursuant to the staff recommendation and recommend a yes vote.
Moved by Vice Chair Neely, seconded by Commissioner Riley. They're asking for the maker and seconder of the motion for a yes vote. Passage of this motion will result in the approval of the permit as conditioned and adoption of the following resolutions and findings as contained in this staff report. Do you want to speak to your motion?
I'd just like to commend the staff. I think they did a great job on this one.
Commissioner Riley, anything else? Okay, Commissioner Juan.
I have a question of staff. You're allowing the placement of the barn just 15 feet from the wetlands, and I realize that it's an improved situation over what exists now, but how is only a 15-foot setback consistent with wetland protection policies? And, you know, is there a basis for saying that this provides adequate protection for those wetlands? That's a very small buffer.
It is very small, and we looked at whether there were alternatives that would provide a bigger buffer, but there simply aren't close enough to the site for the structure to fulfill its function. But our view on it was that the structure exists now directly within the wetland in close proximity to where it's being moved to. And so the impacts on wildlife usage are already occurring on the site, and this will improve upon it and won't worsen the situation. The impacts are already occurring with regard to the barn that's there.
The other concern that we had when we went over this was that if we denied it, that they would take steps to remodel what was there. And we didn't want them doing that. We really wanted them to move it out. So it was one of those cases where we just had to make some trade-offs, and this was the best we could do. And, you know, yesterday the discussion on buffers, I think this just shows you that you have to take them on a case-by-case basis, and then sometimes there are unique circumstances that warrant a deviation from what we normally do. So that's our explanation.
Commissioner Riley?
Well, I just say that when I looked at Exhibit 6, in terms of the current condition there, it'd be quite a remodel.
It would, but if that's the only choice they had.
That's good.
You're right, though.
Okay, we have a motion and a second on the floor. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this? Hearing none, the commission unanimously approves a coastal development permit for the proposed development and adopts the findings set forth in the staff report. Next item would be 13C.
Item 13C is the application of Robert and Sharon Elliott to construct a 2,115 square foot, 20-story, excuse me, two-story, pardon me, it is Friday, I guess, two-story single-family home with a maximum height of 25 feet 8 inches from natural ground, and it would also include a 658-square-foot garage and ancillary facilities including a pump house, driveway, septic system, fencing, landscaping, and underground utilities. And this would be located in the rural village of Albion on the Mendocino coast, not too far from the previous item. As I mentioned, there's an addendum for this item, and this addendum makes certain changes and additions to the staff recommendation. It also includes five items of correspondence, which included three letters specific to the proposed project received from the applicant's representatives, which are collectively attachment one, letters from neighbor Beth Bosk, appellant Rixanne Warren, both of which are either in support or not objecting to the project, and two items of correspondence regarding the indemnification condition, special condition number six, including letters from Keith Adams, representing the Coastal Property Owners Association of Santa Cruz County, and a separate letter from 1,000 Friends of the California Coast. As I noted, the applicant's representative distributed another copy of the letter from Mr. Adams. The commission found that the appeal that this generated from raised a substantial issue at the January commission meeting. The primary issue raised by the project is the project's consistency with the visual resource findings or policies of the certified LCP. Projects both in an area designated as highly scenic near a ridgeline above the Albion River on the east side of Highway 1, and it's also within an area planned as rural village, which has its own special visual protections. The parcel sits above the clustered village of Albion, and it's the last undeveloped parcel within that village, and it's highly visible from the Albion River Bridge. For purposes of this proceeding, the de novo portion of the hearing, the applicants have submitted revised project plans that make changes to the development as approved by the county that we believe make the project supportable. The project revisions include reducing the total square footage of the development from 3,551 square feet to 2,773 square feet, siting the residence an additional 5 feet down slope from the eastern property boundary, reducing the height by a couple of feet, reducing the pitch of the roof from 8 to 12 to 6.5 to 12, and reducing the width of the west-facing elevation, which is the critical elevation facing Highway 1, reducing the expanse of that view of the building from 64 feet to 54 feet by eliminating part of the structural bulk from the southeast portion of the development. In addition, the proposal includes installing native landscaping at the site. We're recommending approval of the permit for the proposed residence with modifications as modified in the addendum. The LCP standards governing visual resources require a number of things, including that the development be subordinate to the character of its setting, that ensuring that the scale of new development is within the scope and character of existing development in the surrounding neighborhood, minimizing landform alteration, and minimizing the impacts of developments on hillsides by preventing development that would project above the ridgeline silhouette. Based on a site visit that we conducted to view new story poles that the applicant had put up after the redesign of the project, we determined that although the proposed residence would appear to rise above the ridgeline when viewed from Highway 1, the projection would be set against the background of existing trees. A portion would be within existing sky, but it would not project above the height of the surrounding trees. And so, in other words, we felt that it did not extend above the ridgeline silhouette. And I have some slides that I'll show you in a minute that will demonstrate this. Additionally, the scale of the development would be within the scope and character of existing development in the surrounding neighborhood. Based on the total square footage, the residence would be larger than the average of several surrounding homes, and even larger still than the surrounding homes that are located in the rural village district, but the perceivable bulk of the structure from southbound Highway 1 has been minimized by reducing that southwest or that west-facing elevation and by scaling back the prominent architectural features of the facade. In addition, the other features of the proposed structures that contributed to the perceived bulk, including the number of stories, the form, the roof style, we believe are generally in keeping with the architectural appearance of the other structures within the rural village district. Furthermore, the height limit would be consistent with the height limit established for the rural village. The project also minimizes landform alteration, and the roof line would blend with the visual angles of the residences on the slopes of the hillside. The applicants have proposed a conceptual landscaping plan that includes planting additional vegetation to screen portions of the development, and we believe that, in general, that landscaping would be effective in muting the appearance of the structure as viewed from Highway 1. There are a number of special conditions that we're recommending to ensure that the project be consistent with the visual resource protection policies. We're including requirements that a final landscaping plan be submitted that limits the amount of limbing and pruning that can be done. We're requiring limits on the colors and materials through special condition number 2A. Special condition 3 requires that a deed restriction detailing the specific restrictions be recorded against the property to ensure that future owners would be aware of those requirements and can maintain the colors and materials and landscaping the manner required. And special condition number 7 requires that future improvements would require an amendment to the permit. There was a special condition number 6 of the staff report, which would have required that the applicant indemnify the commission against third-party lawsuits that could arise with commission approval of the project. We're modifying our recommendation to delete this condition, as we understand that Rixanne Warren, one of the appellants, has submitted a letter in support of the project, and there's no known opposition from anyone else. And so we don't believe there's a need any longer for the condition, and so we're eliminating special condition number 6. Now I'll turn to the slides, and this first slide number 1, is taken on a southbound direction on Highway 1 on the bridge that spans the Albion River, and I need a pointer if there's one available. I'm sorry. Okay. Okay, I'll just use the arrow. Very good. Thank you. Okay, the proposed development on slide 1 is roughly in the location indicated by the mouse arrow on the slide in the middle of the ridge line as viewed from this site. And move to the next slide. Sorry. Okay, thank you.
Now, before you go there, are there 3 other houses already built up there on the ridge that are higher up, or what's
that's
what
correct
is it?
That's correct, Commissioner Riley. Thank you. I'm sorry. There are 3 other houses that are developed in this general area. There's also, you can see here, and you'll see better on some magnified photos later, these are the bulk of the homes in the rural village area, but there are several homes at the top here that are not part of the rural village district, but part of the remote residential. And there is a difference. These are mostly sort of dark browns and earth tones. The buildings in the rural village tend to have a variety of different colors. And our view is that in terms of colors, the location of the proposed development being closer to the rural residential development should have more earth tones rather than the yellows and even blues that you see in this area. Okay. Okay, this next slide is taken near the end of the bridge, the south end of the bridge. The development is located again in this gap. You can see a little bit of the homes to the higher up on the ridge in the rural residential area, and then these are the rural village houses. This is a view taken with a zoom lens, slightly to the north of the last photo, but it shows better the story poles of the proposed development in the middle along the ridgeline. As you can see, this story pole indicates that portions of the house would break the skyline and would be visible against the sky. There are other portions of the development to the left that would be partially backdropped by the existing ridgeline. This is taken a little bit further south. There are story poles where the mouse is pointing, including some story poles in this area, and you can get a better sense of it. Here's the rural village, some of the homes in the rural village. This is further south still, and the story poles extend approximately in this area with a partial backdrop. This is just a photo taken from Albion Ridge Road, which is a road that runs perpendicular to Highway 1 and is actually the access to the project. You can see there are glimpses of the ocean as one proceeds westward down Albion Ridge Road, and these are the story poles for the house. It would affect this momentary view from this location. However, as one drives further south, or excuse me, west along Albion Ridge Road down the hill, there are other glimpses of the ocean that are more pronounced. And then finally, I just include this photo just to give you a point of reference. The previous photos taken from Highway 1 were taken from the Albion River Bridge, which is shown in this slide number 8. Disregard these story poles. They were story poles from the original design that have since been modified, and this is simply just to give you a point of reference. And so that concludes the slides. The addendum, besides including the correspondence that I noted, does make certain changes to the conditions and certain finding changes. Among the changes to the conditions that we have made that the applicant had requested, albeit in some cases in a slightly different form, are changes to the landscaping plan condition, special condition number 1, which would make it clear that the vegetation pruning and trimming of visually screening trees that requires an amendment, that would not apply to trimming that's needed to abate a nuisance. That abatement of a nuisance is not something that requires a permit consistent with the Coastal Act, and so we added language to make that clear. And so, in other words, trimming that might be required by California Division of Forestry and Fire Protection or by PG&E to clear around the wires for safety reasons would not require a permit amendment. The changes also allow that, at the suggestion of the applicant, which we think is a good one, that the vegetation not have to be planted immediately upon completion, but rather planted during the first rainy season after completion of the project to better ensure success of the vegetation plant. And then we also try to include greater specificity of what the final landscaping plan is required to depict. We modified the design restrictions condition number 2, to specify that the development must be composed of the particular materials and colors proposed by the applicant, and that changes to the color would continue to require an amendment. However, we specified what those colors are that are proposed, and those colors are very general: hunter green, weathered wood, light brown. So, you know, slight variations or minor changes resulting from using different paint products can likely be accommodated so long as they're within that color range without having an amendment. We do believe, though, that since the visual character is the principal issue raised here, that if they were to propose significantly different colors, that it would require an amendment so the commission can ensure that it's consistent with the character of the area. And as I noted earlier, we are dropping special condition number 6, the indemnification condition. There were a number of changes requested by the applicant that we are not making. Chief among them is the request to change special condition number 3, which is the requirement that a deed restriction be recorded that would record the conditions of the permit as conditions, covenants, and restrictions against the deed. We continue to believe this condition is necessary to ensure that future buyers will be aware of these various restrictions imposed by the conditions I've just described. The recordation of a deed restriction would ensure that they appear that they appear on a title report at the time that someone is buying the property. The applicants have suggested that instead of a deed restriction, perhaps a notice could be recorded against the property. But our understanding in talking with our legal staff is that there's an important difference between recording a notice against the property and a deed restriction. A notice against the property does not appear necessarily on a title report. One would have to, a prospective buyer would have to actually go to the recorder's office and choose to review all the notices recorded against the property to discover it. Whereas if it's included as a deed restriction, it automatically gets included in the title report. And as a result, there'd be much greater likelihood the future owners would be aware of it and comply with the restrictions. We also chose not to delete special condition number 4 and its requirements to employ best management practices to avoid sedimentation impacts. Even though the grading will be somewhat minor, there still will be some grading that could allow sediment to discharge to the Albion River. So we've retained that condition. And we also didn't delete conditions that the applicant contends were duplicative with the county's approval. We don't believe they are duplicative, as the only discretionary permit approved by the county for the project was the coastal development permit that was appealed. And this permit, of course, never went into effect after it was determined by the commission to raise a substantial issue. So we aren't persuaded that the conditions would be duplicative. So in conclusion, staff believes that the project as conditioned is consistent with the visual resource protection policies of the Mendocino LCP. And we believe the project as conditioned and as modified by the staff addendum is consistent with all other LCP policies, and we recommend that you adopt the recommendation as so modified. And the motion for approval is listed on page 7 of the staff report. Thank you,
Mr. Merrill. With that, I'll come back to the commission for ex parte, starting on my left. No ex parties. With that, I'll go to Vice Chair Neal. Oh, wait a minute. I got a speaker slip, don't we? We have one, don't we? Yeah. Greetings. Mr. Norbert Dahl. Thank you. Sorry. And, sir, how much time are you requesting?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners Norbert Dahl, Dahl and Associates for the Elliott family. Mr. Chairman, may I ask, does the commission have any other speaker slips from any other person?
No, you'd just be rebutting yourself today. No other
speaker
slips.
I'm properly admonished.
How much
May I ask for 10 minutes, please?
Yes, you can.
May I get 10 minutes?
Yes, you can.
Thank you. Commissioners, just one quick housekeeping item.
Your name for the record?
Oh, sorry. Norbert Dahl, Dahl and Associates for the Elliott family. We would request that the recording of Commission's proceedings from Wednesday, May 9, on items 15E and 18 regarding indemnification be included by reference in the record of this proceeding. Commissioners, the Elliott's finite project for a 2,115-square-foot house with native vine-covered fence, significant other native landscaping, including a bioswale to infiltrate all runoff from the roof or any other impervious surface to ground on site, less than 100 cubic yards of grading, and the other appurtenances that normally go with the house, on a 40,000-square-foot parcel, is on the merits fully consistent with all applicable policy and zoning, height, setback, and visual quality protection standards of the Mendocino County LCP that this commission certified. That LCP is the sole standard of review, and the project, because it is fully consistent, deserves your approval today. The Elliotts have worked with the commission staff, and I personally want to commend Mr. Merrill and his staff, since January, to address and resolve staff's issues. For commissioners not familiar with this part of the historically heavily logged part of the Mendocino Coast, the Elliotts parcel is over 1,200 feet inland of Highway 1, below three other houses, as you saw in slide number 1, in the immediate neighborhood, and very importantly, 60 to 80 feet below the Albion Ridge that is mapped by the U.S. Geological Survey. The LCP itself does not present any separate evidence as to what the ridgeline or the peak or the top of the ridge is. The House, commissioners, very clearly does not extend above the ridgeline of Albion Ridge as mapped by USGS. What the slides show is the neighbor's cut embankment, this is Ms. Bosk, for her driveway to her blue house on the adjacent parcel to the northeast. The property contains no wildlife corridor. It contains no other ESHA. You saw the overhead utility lines and poles, not only on the east side of Highway 1 that in part interfere with the public's appreciation of what is a nice view inland, but also along the road right-of-way of Albion Ridge Road. Importantly, Albion Ridge Road is not the ridge. In addition, you didn't see it in these slides, but those of you who have been along Highway 1 through this part of Mendocino County know that in Albion, immediately adjacent to Highway 1, there are very large shed roof structures that are the Albion Village Commercial Center. It's where the fire department is located and various other facilities. They are very visually prominent, and they are massive compared to this house, which has a 1,475 square foot footprint. The only third-party appellant, Ms. Warren, has sent you a letter in which she applauds staff's work as having resulted in a smaller blended house, and I quote here, and protection for the residents' view of Albion Cove. In addition, the addendum that Mr. Merrill handed out last night has a two-page memorandum letter from Ms. Bosk, who's the neighbor in the blue house to the northeast. Clearly, her house is upslope of the Elliott's property, and her private driveway abuts the easterly property line. Without any citation to the LCP, she has one concern. Her concern is that the Elliott's want to fence their property, not an unreasonable request, totally consistent with the LCP. The Elliott's, because they are sensitive to the visual quality, have in the landscaping plan provided for two locally native vines. One is Dutchman's Pipe, recommended by the Alexander Valley native nurseryman, and the other one is the local honeysuckle, recommended by the native botanist at Jug Handle Nature Preserve. Those are two of the three premier native botanists in the area. The third one, with whom the Elliott's consulted, was the native botanist at the Mendocino Botanical Gardens, who also concurred that the plant list that is on the landscape plan are the appropriate natives. Ms. Bach has some concerns. Her concerns are, and she misunderstood, she thought that the local ceanothus was in fact going to be used as vegetation along the fence. We want to be very clear, it is not. The nearest place where that plant will be located is downslope and away from her property line. In addition, she differs with staff and the Elliott's in saying in her letter that she'd rather the house be painted in blues and yellows and whites, akin to the older houses in Albion, rather than the greens and the earth tones that the Elliott's, very candidly, worked out with Mr. Merrill and his staff. We recommend that the commission stay with the staff recommendation with regard to that, precisely because that color scheme blends the house with the backdrop. Commissioners, 156 days have passed since Ms. Warren filed her appeal with the commission. The Elliott's have not waived time and indeed have reserved all their rights. As the commission knows, the commission did not hold a public hearing within 49 days on this, at which the public could testify, and also didn't act within 21 days as the mandatory requirement in 30622 provides. The opponents seem to have no substantive objections under the LCP to the project. Let me quickly turn to the special conditions. We commend Mr. Merrill and his staff for the interactive, constructive work in which they've engaged. Bob Elliott, who is an attorney with another state regulatory agency, has asked us to bring the following very specific and limited matters to your attention. And needless to say, we appreciate Mr. Douglas's and Mr. Elliott's removal of Special Condition 6 with regard to the indemnification from their staff recommendation. The first one has to do, and I would ask that you turn to the staff report at page 11, the de novo staff report. I beg your pardon. It comes a few pages earlier, page 8. The amended version that Mr. Merrill handed out fundamentally limits limbing and pruning of the trees to nuisances, to avoiding nuisances. We would submit to you that management of the trees for their health in case one of them is infected or otherwise damaged is a valid additional concern, and we have provided language in our Exhibit 3 that specifically allows vegetation management only to be done consistent with the approved landscape plan, but does not require a permit amendment every time Bob Elliott or his mother or his son want to prune a tree for legitimate reasons. The Elliotts are more committed than anyone to maintaining the backdrop of the vegetation for their house because it's also partly their privacy. But this is a reasonable exercise of a property owner's ability to manage trees that are all planted. These are not naturally occurring trees here. And we would submit to you that our language does the job in a manner that limiting it to nuisance control does not. Let me quickly go to the other condition, which is Special Condition 3. There are two parts to this. The first one is, as written by staff, the deed restriction would utilize conditions, covenants, and restrictions, CC&Rs. This project involves no subdivision. CC&Rs expire by their own terms after 21 years. CC&Rs are not the effective tool to achieve what your staff wants. We would ask that, at a minimum, that be deleted. The second part with regard to deed restrictions are Bob Elliott, who happens to specialize in this part of the law, reminds us that unlike, say, the Department of Toxic Substances Control, which has specific authorization to exact covenants similar to deed restrictions that was given by the legislature, the Coastal Commission was not given that authority. And Mr. Elliott asks you to consider that under the reasonable conditions clause to effectuate the Coastal Act, you have no specific authority to require a deed restriction. He's absolutely committed to recording the conditions. That's not the issue. It's the technique, the legal instrument of how we get there. Commissioners, I see I have 10 seconds on the clock. I bid you a fair weekend, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Dahl. With that, I'll go back to staff. Mr. Merrill.
I have a couple of comments, and I don't know if council would like to comment on the deed restriction issue, but with regard to condition one, the landscaping and the requirement that limbing and pruning receive an amendment, we did add the language that indicates that amendment would not be needed if it's limbing and pruning needed to abate a nuisance, which is specifically designed to cover situations where they're removing vegetation at the direction of CDF for fire protection purposes or for removing limbs that are endangering the power lines. So we believe that that concern has been taken care of. The deed restriction provision, you know, we continue to think that it is needed, as I've stated, to alert future buyers of the need for it. You know, my understanding that is that since this is a condition of a permit, and the commission is not unilaterally requiring that a deed restriction be imposed, it's only as a condition of approval in exchange for the benefit of a coastal development permit, that this is something that the commission does have the authority to impose. But I'll defer to council for a further comment on that if they care to make any.
Ms. Roach?
Commissioners, I'll add that legal counsel does agree that the commission has the authority to require a deed restriction. The Coastal Act does authorize the commission to impose conditions that are necessary to make development consistent with the Coastal Act, or in this case, an LCP. Here, the staff is recommending conditions that will address visual issues, conditions that will need to be complied with in perpetuity. So in order for those conditions to be complied with in perpetuity, owners need to know about them. Recording the deed restriction is a way to help ensure that future owners will have actual notice of the requirements so that they can comply and so that the development will be consistent with the LCP. So we do agree that the deed restriction is authorized.
And I would just add that the Coastal Commission has been using deed restrictions for over 30 years.
Thank you, Director Douglas. And with that, I'll come back to the Commission, Vice Chair Neely, then Commissioner Wan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Commission approve Coastal Development Permit Number A-1-MEN-06-047, subject to the conditions, and recommend a yes vote.
Moved by Vice Chair Neely, seconded by Commissioner Riley. They're both the maker and seconder are asking for a yes vote. Passage of this motion will result in the approval of the permit as condition and adoption of the following resolutions and findings. Speak to your motion.
Just to say that all issues I had concerns with have been addressed in the conditions.
Commissioner Riley?
To mention that my guess is that the botanist was in Anderson Valley, not Alexander Valley.
Okay. If, Commissioner Wan?
I have a couple of questions of staff. The houses that are referenced, the three houses that are on the ridge that are above the ridge line, are those pre-coastal?
I believe all three, at least a couple of them, are more recent vintage, and they were approved after certification of the LCP by the county.
Okay, well, that helps, because my concern here dealt with using tree line as ridge line. And frankly, I don't see anything in the policies that you cited that specifies that a ridge line is defined by the tree line. So from my perspective, that can't be the basis for allowing this to protrude above the ridge line. On the other hand, if the other houses there are post-certification of the LCP, then the character of the neighborhood may be a basis. And I'll go along with it. But I am concerned about the statements in the staff report that in essence say that you can define a ridge line on the basis of the tops of the tree line. They're not one and the same, and I don't think that should be, you know, part of the basis for it. You do have a basis, but that's not the basis.
Thank you, Commissioner Wan. Commissioner Blank.
Just a question for staff. I understand we deleted Special Condition 6, the our favorite clause, but help me understand on page 7 of the addendum, am I just misreading it, which is more than possible, did we add in findings in item 8?
The change to delete the special condition number 6 we just made today after this addendum had been prepared.
Okay.
So what you see there on page 7 are actually findings that we were at that point when we did the addendum adding to support special condition number 6.
So
but these would be deleted as well.
We are deleting this finding as well.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, I'll call for the question. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the commission unanimously approves the coastal development permit for the proposed development and adopts the findings set forth in this staff report. Okay.
That brings us to item 13D, which is the application of the City of Crescent City to reconstruct the Crescent City Wastewater Treatment Plant near Battery Point at Battery and B Streets in Crescent City. Again, there is a staff addendum for this item. The addendum replaces special condition number 1 with the new conditions and makes associated changes to the findings to reflect the change, which I'll discuss a bit more later. The project involves upgrades that are needed because the current 1.8 million gallon per day dry weather flow capacity of the facility can no longer adequately meet the service area's need for treatment of wastewater. A new facility is critical to both
provide for current needs, but also to provide for the estimated 22.8 million gallons per day of peak wet weather inflow resulting from the rainy season influx of stormwater and groundwater that finds its way into holes in the collection system and occasionally overwhelms the treatment system, resulting in periodic discharges of untreated effluent to the ocean. The treatment plant upgrade is a continuation of a series of facility improvements mandated by the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board through a series of cease and desist and waste discharge requirement orders issued to the city since 1997. Most of the projects was within the Commission's retained jurisdiction, although about a quarter of it's within the City of Crescent City jurisdiction, for which the city's already issued a coastal development permit that was not appealed to the Commission. The service area of the plant covers the entire city of Crescent City and large portions of the surrounding unincorporated county area, and about half of the service area includes areas outside the coastal zone. Principal issue raised by the project is whether the expanded plant capacity would be sufficiently limited to only support the sewage treatment demands of the planned levels of new development under the certified LCPs. Section 30254 of the Coastal Act requires that new or expanded public works facilities be designed and limited to only accommodate needs generated by levels of development in the area served by the facility that are found to be consistent with the Coastal Act. The intent is not to induce growth that exceeds planned densities by providing too much capacity. The densities are really specified by the certified LCPs in terms of the build-out that they would accommodate. In this case, the exercise of making sure the planned treatment capacity matches planned development is made more complicated by the fact that only portions of the service area are within the coastal zone, and that portion is within area covered by two separate LCPs, the City of Crescent City and Delnard County. The expansion of the wastewater treatment plant would provide for full biological treatment at volumes up to 5.5 million gallons per day. Of sewage from the surrounding community. It would also provide for 22.8 million gallons per day of treatment of wet weather overflow through a process that provides less than full biological treatment. The 5.5 does receive full biological treatment through a more extensive process. The treatment afforded for the wet weather flows is viewed as being adequate by the regional board since the volume is largely diluted, but it would not be acceptable for or appropriate for treating normal average dry weather flows. The anticipated full build-out in 2027 within the area covered by the service area and also within the certified LCP areas of the City of Crescent City and Delnard County roughly generate a demand for waste treatment of approximately 5.47 million gallons per day. And so the expected treatment capacity of 5.5 million gallons closely matches that amount. And based on our review of the sewage demand generated by build out and the capacity that would be provided, we believe that the plant capacity does match well with demand generated by planned growth. One thing that we'd been concerned about, however, was whether future anticipated improvements to the sewage collection system that would reduce the amount of groundwater and surface water that flow into the system unintentionally during wet weather periods, whether improvements to that collection system would somehow result in more available capacity. If that volume dropped significantly below the 22.8 million gallons projected, would that suddenly make more capacity available for residential use beyond what, or industrial growth use that's beyond the planned densities in the LCPs? To address that concern, our original staff recommendation would have imposed special condition number one, which would have said that any capacity gained in that manner could not be used to accommodate more density. And it also included various reporting requirements that required extensive analysis every time that sewage collection system improvements were proposed so that we would know about improvements of that type that could potentially increase capacity and deal with them. However, after publishing the staff report, we did meet with the applicants, and we understand better the situation that any reduction in wet weather flows would not translate into greater capacity for treating normal sewage, because as I had mentioned, the 22.8 million gallons per day volume that's largely a result of the wet weather overflow goes through an abbreviated treatment processing system that doesn't conform to standards for complete residential treatment during the dry weather period. So in other words, if there are reductions, it would simply just reduce the amount that's shunted to that level of treatment that's not as full as what's provided for dry weather flows, and it would not result in an increase in capacity for dry weather flows. Those flows still have to meet regional board standards through its waste discharge requirements imposed to the city. So therefore, we're deleting special condition number one as described in the addendum as it's written in the staff recommendation, and we're substituting for that a condition that would simply require that as this phased project over time, as it's implemented, if there are design changes, those need to be the subject of a permit amendment so that the commission would have the opportunity to review whether those design changes change this balance of capacity and demand for sewage that's allowed under the LCP. So in conclusion, staff believes that the project as conditioned and with the modifications in the addendum is consistent with Section 30254 of the Coastal Act, as well as the other pertinent policies of the Coastal Act, and we're recommending that you adopt the staff recommendation as modified. The motion is found on page 8 of the staff report. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Merrill.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment for the record. The workload of the North Coast staff is really incredible, as I'm finding out. And fortunately, we were able to fill a vacancy up there, and that's helping. But one of the issues we had here was the dilemma of dealing with a major restoration project in the city of Arcata with the Department of Fish and Game. This project, I had been in communication with local elected officials on this. Bob and I had talked about how we're going to allocate work. We had to make a decision of what was more important to get onto this agenda. Department of Fish and Game and City of Arcata are very unhappy that their project didn't get on the agenda, and I just said I had to make a choice, and we felt this project was more important to bring forward today because of the need to upgrade this system. So I just wanted to add some context to this, and I can tell Fish and Game that I reported this to you.
Thank you. And from my perspective, it comes under too much information. Thank you. But thank you very much for that. We'll go to the commission ex parties, starting on my left. No ex parties at all? Okay. And with that, I'll go to Vice. Oh, wait a minute. We have one speaker. We'll open the public hearing. And we have one speaker slip here, Jim Brandt from the city of Crescent City. Sir, how much time are you requesting? 2 minutes. Yes, sir.
Simply to say I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Crescent City. Working with the staff, we have, I think, defined the conditions in a way such
could
that we,
you,
I think...
Could you state your name for the record?
Jim Barnes.
Right.
Yeah.
Barnes. Thank you.
And so I'm basically here for any questions you might have, any history. And we do appreciate you taking this matter up at this time because of the weather on the North Coast. We have a very short construction season. We have some deep holes and all that. So thank you for taking this matter under consideration, and I am here for any questions.
Thank you for being here today. Vice Chair, we'll close the public hearing. Any other comments from staff? No other comments from staff. Go back to the commission. Vice Chair Neely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the commission approve coastal development permit number 1-07-002. Pursuant to the staff recommendation, recommend a yes vote.
Moved by Vice Chair Neely, seconded by Commissioner Riley. They're both asking for a yes vote. Passage of this motion will result in the approval of the permit as conditioned and adoption of the following resolutions and findings as contained in this staff report. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the commission unanimously approves a coastal development permit for the proposed development and adopts the findings set forth in this staff report. Thank you. Now, we have one public speaker, and we'll go to that now. Andy Lee. Bob. Thank you,
Chairman and members of the Commission.
How much time, sir, are you requesting?
I think 3 minutes will do.
Thank you.
Great. My name is Andy Lee, and I wanted to alert Commission staff and members of the Commission about a project in Grover Beach, California, and to submit a letter expressing environmental concerns over the project. The letter is signed by 6 organizations: the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club, which represents 2,500 Sierra Club members in San Luis Obispo County; the San Luis Bay chapter of the Surfrider Foundation; the San Luis Obispo Coastkeeper Program; the Southern California Watershed Alliance; the San Francisco Office of Clean Water Action; environmental attorney Corey Briggs of Briggs Law Corporation, as well as my organization, which is Unite Here, the Hotel Employees Union. The Commission has appeal rights over this project, which the undersigned feel it should use in this case to request an appealability hearing and a de novo hearing. The project appealability period may open by early June, and we believe the project's local coastal permit may be inconsistent with the City of Grover Beach's local coastal plan. The project itself is a Hilton Garden Inn, and it is within 100 feet of Meadow Creek, which is a tributary of the Pacific Ocean. It is also within 800 feet of the Pismo Lake Ecological Reserve. According to the city's local coastal plan, both bodies of water are classified as, quote, sensitive habitat areas. The coastal plan further states that, quote, development upland of the environmentally sensitive habitat area and its adjacent buffer shall be sited and designed to prevent impacts which would significantly degrade the Meadow Creek and downstream Pismo Lake environs and shall be compatible with the continuance of those habitat areas. The project could have significant impacts. For example, the mitigated negative declaration for the project states that, quote, implementation of the proposed project would create additional paved and impermeable surfaces which could contribute to urban stormwater runoff, including oil, fuels, and sediment. Impacts are considered potentially significant. Although there are some proposed mitigations for these impacts, we're concerned that they're based on a mitigated negative declaration rather than a full EIR. The City of Grover Beach justified this on the grounds that an EIR was conducted for the same location in 1992 for a bowling alley proposed at the same piece of land. We believe there are 4 problems with this, and that failure to conduct a full EIR may violate the local coastal plan's cautions over careful development near the sensitive habitat areas of Meadow Creek and the reserve. We believe 15 years is too much time to assume that environmental factors have not changed in the area. 2, we believe that the 1992 EIR discussed a fundamentally different and smaller project. The square footage of the hotel is more than twice the amount of the square footage of the bowling alley, and we believe that the hotel will have different impacts from the bowling alley. For example, 44% of the hotel project's acreage is set aside for landscaping, and we believe that this raises the possibility of fertilizers, herbicides, and pesticides draining into the wetlands. That's an issue that was not studied in either the 1992 EIR or the current mitigated negative declaration. 3, the mitigated negative declaration does not discuss 2 critical impacts that were discussed in the 1992 EIR, namely surface runoff and biological resources. 4, failure to conduct a full EIR may violate provisions of the State Coastal Act. We believe that in not studying or mitigating impacts to sensitive habitat areas through an EIR process, the project may be inconsistent with the policies in sections 30231, 30240, and 30250 of the State Public Resources Code, which deal with minimizing the impacts of new development on sensitive habitat. And for many of the reasons stated above, we feel there are substantive issues here that warrant a de novo hearing for the project.
Mr. Lee, your time is up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir, for coming. And that was the last public comment period. Anything else from staff before we close the hearing today. We'll just see all the commissioners.
No, except that I did suggest that you think about 4 days for July.
Okay, and then we'll see everybody in Commissioner Riley's district in Santa Rosa next month.
Right.
That'll be nice. He just needs to have the wine ready, and you know. So we'll all be there, and so
we'll see you next month.
See you next month.
Right.
Thank you.
Bye.